All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Testing.
Should we keep the window open or not?
Doesn't seem that busy. Your mum's back now.
That's not my mum. That's some old geezer.
It's the same car. I see your mum's car everywhere and I think, oh, that's Deb. There's loads of them.
Just any red Ford Fiesta.
Yeah.
That must be Deb.
Yeah.
All right, so we're back for another episode. We're going to start the preamble ramble off this week with a biggie sporting upset. So, after legendary boxer and personal favourite of yours, Jim, Manny Pacquiao, suffered a shock loss, I want to talk about some of the biggest sporting upsets in this week's Preamble Ramble. In your mind, what could be considered as the biggest shock in sporting history?
Well, first of all, it's a compliment to Pacquiao that you put this result up in the heavens with some of the biggest upsets in history. It's just a testament to the man himself.
And it was only like a 1-4 favourite as well.
Yeah, so,
why is it even like... He's like 75% chance winning.
But I was thinking... A recent one, it's got to be Leicester winning the Premier League. Ranieri and the Peter boys. Vardy, Mahrez, Kante. I mean, come on. That is one of the most shocking things that's happened in football in the last however many years.
I think it was the Rugby World Cup. I want to say it was the one that was in England. Was it 2014 something or 2016, 2015, somewhere around there? Because I'm sure there was a game at Milton Keynes. And I'm not sure if this game, particular game that I'm thinking of, was in Milton Keynes. But I was there at the time. And it was Japan beat like New Zealand or Australia, and they were like, I swear they were like 500-1 or something to beat them.
Absolutely screwing! You'd never pick that one, would you?
Like not in a million years. Like it was the weirdest odds for a single game I've ever seen in my life.
It must have been on the session, the big Kiwis, man.
Or they had like a good old bet on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, good old bet. But I thought as well about Jesse Owens at the Berlin Olympics in 1936.
Oh, yeah, pre-Nazi. Oh, during the Nazi regime.
This is when Time magazine was still calling Hitler the man of the year and all that. Jesse Owens rolls up, gets 4 gold medals in the sprinting, lays the Aryan myth to dust.
Yeah, because that was sort of the term they used for him. And I thought that really funny because apparently D. Roosevelt didn't even invite him for a handshake. After he basically slaughtered the Aryan myth of them being better than everyone else,
and then
your president didn't even like bring him into the White House, like
Joe.
You know what I mean?
Joe Lewis had to do the same kind of thing around the same time, man, because he lost to Max Schmeling, and they were like, yeah, up the Nazis, up the Whites, and all that. Fought him again like 3 years later, smashed him to bits, knocked him down like 8 times in the first round. So. Nice one for the boys there.
Yeah, anything else you can think of? I mean, I suppose the Leicester Premier League one, I think they weren't they like 5,000-1 or something to win it?
Something like that. And I think a couple of lads cashed out around February because they're thinking this is too good to be true. And they carried on whopping the boys.
Yeah, I just remember with 12 games to go, everybody was saying like, nah, they'll fall off. And then they beat like Man City 3-1 away. They were beating like Tottenham.
Some of Vardy's goals during that run were ridiculous, man.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Van Persie-esque.
And then Mahrez was doing the same thing that he always did. He'd be like on the right wing, he'd cut onto his left foot, and he's like, you know what's going to happen, don't you? Like, don't let him cut onto his left. It was pissing me off every time I watched it.
It's a bit mad that Vardy stayed there. Mahrez went to City,
Kante went to Chelsea, won back-to-back Premier League titles. I'm not sure if that's ever been done. And Vardy stayed. Even though Arsenal, I think, made an offer for him when he was about 31, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, couldn't lure him to the Emirates.
Oh, would you forget? We're going to talk about them a little bit later, man.
Sick of talking about every week.
I know, yeah.
Well, there's going to be some positive stuff to go in there, I think, this week.
Yeah, it'd be all right, but it's still a bit depressing. Not as uplifting as Blues news this week.
Yeah, well, there's a 6-0 for Arsenal, 5-0 for Blues, even though they lost 2-0 in the Cup to Fulham the other day. But
can't have it all, can you?
No, you can't have it all. Right, so kick us off with the 5 things you might miss then.
The former communications director for the Los Angeles Angels, which are a baseball team. This guy's name's Eric Kay. He's currently on trial for felony distribution in connection to the death of Angels pitcher Tyler Skaggs in 2019. Prosecutors allege Kay was running an opioid distribution ring within the team, dealing to around 5 players, and sometimes having his dealer drop off to the stadium in exchange for tickets and merchandise. So one part of me wants to call this guy a legend, and the other half is like, what are you doing, man? That is absolutely psychotic behaviour.
That sounds mental. Like, that doesn't sound real, does it? Like,
no, it don't. So I was reading through it thinking, this is like Moneyball 2 right here, man. Absolutely sick.
It's going to make a good film in a few years,
regardless. Yeah, as if you're saying, yeah, just drop it off at the stadium, mate.
Yeah.
At the stadium? We're at work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this this Tyler Skaggs, did he die of a drug overdose or something?
Yeah, related to that, innit? So obviously they're trying to rope him. If he's seen to be dealing within the team and Skaggs died as a result of opioid abuse, then he's in some way culpable, I'm assuming, in US law.
Doesn't seem like something that would happen at a huge like US, you know, sports franchise.
But they're all dealing with injuries and stuff, aren't they? So like you're only... If you take a strong painkiller, if you've got a jacked up shoulder or an elbow or something like that, and you constantly take that, and then the painkiller stops working, then you have to go to something stronger. It's easy done.
I love the way the dealer wanted in exchange was tickets. Yeah. Tickets and maybe like an Angels jersey. Oh yeah, what do you want for it? Like, do you want $500 cash? Well, nah, just get us a couple of tickets to the shitty game. Like,
I think Kay was saying, just drop them there and I'll give you tickets or I'll give you merchandise, I'll give you signed gloves and stuff like that. He must have been absolutely clocking that. Because he was in treatment for opioid abuse himself when he was alleged to be doing this. He's on the stuff himself, isn't he?
All right, so number two, one of the most bizarre golf shots you're ever likely to see occurred at this weekend's Northern Trust Golf Tournament, as this year's Masters winner Hideki Matsuyama hit a wayward tee shot that found its way towards a group of spectators and managed to bounce up the shorts and into the shirt of an unsuspecting spectator.
Lovely.
So the fan had to wait a couple of minutes for Hideki to make his way over to him so they could spot the ball, but the fan did get lucky and walked away with a signed golf ball from Hideki.
Was the fan male or female?
Male.
Boom.
And he was quite plump.
Plump as well.
And he was wearing shorts and somehow he bounced up his short and he was just like hung onto his shirt there.
Did they get the bounce on camera? Because there's a very good possibility that guy, he landed next to the guy and he's picked up and just shoved it up his shorts.
I mean, yeah, there is a probably. But the thing is, like, obviously, I think you got to play where it lies, isn't it? But obviously, there's limits there, isn't it? Because you're not going to try and whack this geezer, like, you know what I mean? So he had to sort of just like, everyone was like, wait, they were like, wait for it, wait for it. And then he like, you know, opened his shirt and it dropped and everyone was like, oh.
Oh, so the guy who it was stuck on, he had to let it fall.
Yeah, he had to let it fall. But like, I think they basically spotted it where he stood. So Hideki had to play it from there and he didn't play it from where it fell.
It's quite unlikely that, isn't it?
Very, very unlikely. Almost as unlikely as hitting your dad. No, as in physically hitting your dad.
Bit of repression coming out there, is it?
No, I'm saying like Rory McIlroy, I think it was a few earlier this year, he hit his dad with a golf ball, didn't he, after playing a shot?
That's hilarious, man. I just thought, I didn't know where that was going. It's almost unlikely as hitting your dad, which I really want to do. Yeah. But almost as unlikely as one of the best talents of a generation falling to the wayside, like Jack Wilshere. Number three. What a segue. Oh, it's unreal. I'm feeling pretty hot today. So, Jack Wilshere. I saw this across about 3 or 4 news outlets. So I can only imagine him and his agent or his manager have just put the reds together and thought, we'll put the bat signal up.
Is that Batman reference?
Yeah, the bat signal.
Yeah, as in like the thing.
Yeah.
Because he needs help.
The police put the bat signal up because they need help. Batman doesn't put the bat signal up.
Oh, okay, so Jack Wilshere isn't putting the bat
signal. He's putting the bat signal up because he needs help.
Okay, so who put it up for him?
Well, him and his agent and his manager.
Oh, his agent, yeah. We'll say his agent put the bat signal up.
Did you not know that worked? So, he's 29 years old, Wilshere. He was once touted as one of the best prospects in English football. He was at Arsenal for a decade, and at his peak, he was able to hold his own against Xavi and Iniesta during Barcelona's golden age. I can't believe
that's a stretch.
Nah, come on. They beat Barca 2 or 3 times while he was in his prime, and people at the time were absolutely jizzing all over Wilshere, man. They were like, oh, I can't believe it. England golden generation, blah, blah, blah. I swear to God, man, that was the coverage. I remember I used to watch Arsenal regularly at that time. And he scored that goal against Norwich, which we were drooling over last week with the link-up play with Giroud and all that.
Yep.
But he's had loads of injuries. He was loaned to Bournemouth in 2016, went to West Ham on a free transfer in 2018. He made just 19 appearances in 2 years and was released a year early from his contract there. Then one more year at Bournemouth in a championship. And now he's a free agent looking for a club. I think it's a really unfortunate route for such a promising career to take.
I think it's crazy that he's gone from the high level that he was playing at and the talent that he was to not being able to even cut it in the championship. And I can't believe there's not championship clubs that want to take a risk on him. He's only 29 years old. Supposedly he's not had any injuries since like early 2020. He's been training on his own. I feel a bit sorry for him, man. I really do.
I do, but the way the news stories put it across, it was like, oh, I don't know what to tell my son because he's asking me, why don't any clubs want you? and I don't like being heavy-handedly manipulated like that. So now I'm thinking,
pulling your heartstrings.
Yeah, what's really going on? Like, apparently he loves a drink and all that, but loads of players must love a drink. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't really...
Well, wasn't there something about him smoking a lot when he was at Arsenal under Wenger's reign? Like, and they tried to cut it out and that.
And this is what makes me think that this is just a big media campaign to get him hired again, because I thought he was got like criticised for smoking and drinking and all that back in the day. But then I saw a story where Wilshere was saying that Wenger criticised him in public, but in private he had a fag with him. And he was just like, yeah, chill out, just don't go too over the top and all that. It makes me think that wherever he goes, he's starting to have negative influences on the dressing room. Because if you get a player like that in, you think, oh, he's mega talented, link up midfield player, all that kind of stuff. And then he's just a pain in the arse. You'd be like, just get him out the door.
And the news report I was reading was saying his son was getting bullied in school. He's like, I can't see that. Like, you're not going to go up to Jack Walsh's son and be like, ha ha, your dad can't get signed. your dad's shit. Like, he's shit at football. He can't get a contract. Ha-ha. That's not something, I don't know, an 11-year-old kid says, is it?
Ha ha, your dad reached his athletic prime earlier than other people. Ha ha.
Ha ha, your dad peaked too early.
Ha ha, your dad played in Champions League quarterfinals against Messi and the best Barcelona team ever. Ha ha.
He's probably got a lot more money than you anyway, mate, so chill out.
And he's going to be living off that cheddar for years, man.
All right, so number four, sticking with football. French league are tied between... Do you like that? Tie between Nice and Marseille was abandoned on the weekend after a 90-minute delay, which saw projectiles thrown at players, fans invading the pitch and confronting players, and just a general all-out skirmish, which referee Benoit Bastien deemed unattainable, so the match was subsequently called off. The league were apparently keen for the match to continue, but Marseille president cited the reasoning for not continuing being the fact they couldn't guarantee the safety of their players. Nice fans not only got a match abandoned when their team were 1-0 up with 15 minutes left, but will now be banned for their next home game, as that is slated to be played behind closed doors.
Apparently they were launching projectiles the whole time. I think it was Dimitri Payet where he was like...
I think that was the final straw.
I've had enough of this. And then he
bottle picks, of water in that. Yeah.
He picked something back up, launched it back into the crowd, and the commentators were like, don't throw things back. And then the barricade just broke. There's no protection, really. I know, like, in Germany, they've got the high fences and stuff, and that's, like, a bit better. But then you're on, like, always running the risk of some Hillsborough shit happening if things get really out of control. So from a safety measure for the fans, it's better to have that open space between them and the pitch. But for the players, there's only so many stewards. And if the opposing fans decide to rush you, what are you going to do? You're in, like, a life or death situation there. You can easily get trampled there, like, easy.
Yeah, a fan could easily have a shank, like running onto the pitch, couldn't they?
Yeah.
So is this going to dilute the myth a bit that England fans are like hooligans or the worst hooligans? You know what I mean? Because we always seem like our fans always seem to get sort of like bastardised.
Yeah, it's well earned that reputation though. I mean, it's like once you get established as that set of fans, it's pretty hard.
It.
Yeah, it's like people still reckon that Turkey fans are like dirty stabbing bastards because what happened to that Leeds fan back in the day? And you know it must have been kicking off in the street, like six or one, half a dozen of the other. But a lot of people still think of Turkish fans like that. So it just sticks, doesn't it, when you get a ref like that?
Yeah, exactly. And finally, sticking with Ligue 1, the points-based league rankings from UEFA, which takes into consideration the results from each team from the European countries in the UEFA club competitions, has deemed that the French league is no longer a top five league in Europe. The Portuguese Primera has overtaken League One to join the Premier League, Bundesliga, Serie A and La Liga, leaving Messi and co playing in the sixth best league in Europe. PSG, however, are still favourites to win the Champions League at 3-1.
It's an interesting reflection of the balance of that league, because I probably couldn't name you most of the teams in the league, but it's kind of like Man City playing in the Scottish Premier League, isn't it? Something like that with PSG. I know they didn't win the league last year, but in terms of their resources and their star power and their commercial viability.
See, it's mad to me in terms of like betting perspective, like, and value. PSG can't be value like for anything this year because they didn't even win the league last year. Although they have signed like some like mega players, like obviously they signed Donnarumma, they've signed Gigi Wijnaldum, they've signed Messi, they've signed Achraf Hakimi. So they've signed like great players all over the pitch.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you're going to get instant success, does it? And we've seen that with a lot of teams.
Well, you could say that, but then look what happened when Mourinho went to Chelsea, when Abramovich took over. He got the lads in, but he's an exceptional coach as well. Mm. But Pochettino's, like, I wouldn't say he's on Mourinho's level in terms of what he's achieved, but he's definitely one of the top managers in Europe. There's no reason why he can't fit all those golden chess pieces together around
still
the board.
They've never been to a final before, and they're favourites to win the Champions League. For me, I don't think that represents good value.
It's star power, though, isn't it? You're looking at it at a practical betting level, where everyone else is thinking, oh my God, it's like dream team time. It's not. Messi might not even be as impressive when he goes there.
Well, he's 34 at the end of the day. I'm not saying he's lost any of his quality, but you know, you don't know how he's playing in a different league. Obviously, it's a lot poorer.
Don't get me wrong. I think he's going to smash it, but there's every possibility
he's probably going to get 30 goals like minimum. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But that doesn't mean they're going to be the best teams in Europe in the Champions League.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? So we'll see how that progresses. But I would not fancy backing PSG at 3-1. I've backed them in the past 3 years, probably PSG, but they've been like 12s, 14s. So I thought they've always been edging closer and closer, but
they got to the semis last year, didn't they?
Yeah, they got beat by it was Man City. Dortmund, yeah, City, was it? Man City, Dortmund were in one final, and it was PSG and
Chelsea.
Yeah.
Was that the draw? I could have sworn City played.
Nah, because Dortmund. Yeah, because I remember Jude Bellingham had great two games against Man City in the semi final, didn't he?
I remember.
And we were all like, oh, look at the Brummy lads.
Look at them.
Two games absolutely running Man City. Alright, so we're going to move on to the review of the weekend's footy. Lukaku scores his first goal for Chelsea some 10 years after his debut, which I find incredible.
Mate, watching the Arsenal defenders trying to contain him was like watching a bunch of 10-year-olds trying to contain Jonah Loma. It was a mismatch.
Didn't know what to do.
You know when he's dribbling and he's just got his arms outstretched like that and no one can get past that barrier and he's twinkle-toeing it. Yeah. And he's really impressive. Like the give and goes in the middle of the park, obviously the goal. He wants to get there, then he's sprinting, calling for it, shouting for every opportunity. He could have got another one as well, I think.
I think he looks a much more impressive player than he was at United already.
Him losing the weight and he's still a unit. Like there's zero excess on him now. And also, his general play has improved. I think Inter Milan, I think he's given Kante a lot of credit for just
game intelligence. I think he's off the ball run. He's off the ball movement. He's off the ball runs look better as well. I'd be surprised if he doesn't get 15, 20 goals this season with Chelsea.
Yeah, and it was I thought it was going to be a worse result than that. I think it could have easily been 4, 5, 6 on the balance of the game. Leno tipped it onto the bar late on. That could have, you know what I mean? It should have been more probably. To be fair, the result last night against West Brom, you look at it and go 6-0, even though it's against a championship team in the cup.
A championship team that played, that had 6 debutants, I think.
Yeah, so
they were playing basically a West Brom B and C team.
Yeah, and they had all the big guns out there, and the quality of some of the goals, like Aubameyang did good. His third goal was good, and his assist for one of the other goals was good as well. But they weren't astounding in terms of quality. The goals, not really. They were quite scrappy. I think Villa looked better against Barrow the other day. Do you know what I mean? I know Barrow were a lower ranked
playing,
team.
They were playing a lot of their youth players as well. But for me, when I saw the lineup, it was kind of like Arteta a little bit of desperation from him because he was like, I can't put out, because if I put out a weakened side right and we get beat by West Brom, like the fans are going to want my head.
Well, they already want his head. Have you seen the footage of him leaving the ground and them going get out and all it, which I don't really agree with. I mean, like,
it's ridiculous, really. After two games,
it is what it is. But I reckon he's gone, man. Anyway, there's no need to abuse him. Do you know what I mean?
The
results speak for themselves. So,
but you know how passionately we take football. Like, you know, we do go over the top a little bit in sort of how we sort of approach like managerial positions and stuff like that. We'll always want our team to be the team that's winning, and not everybody can have their team winning all the time.
Well, these are the same fans that were going Wenger out when we were finishing fifth. Oh, we can't finish outside of the European spot. Look what happened. Forget. Be careful what you wish for, man.
You can't even sniff the top four, can
no
you?
Like, way, man.
Can't
no
even
way.
Smell it. But West Ham back up their impressive start to the season with a home win over Leicester. Obviously, there was that red card, like a disgusting challenge, in my opinion. Perez, he sort of like went in, about not knee high, but it was about halfway between the knee and the foot.
I watched the highlights of that one, but I don't think I caught that. I remember them referencing, I must have just missed it on the replay, because they were saying that's a disgusting challenge. It looked to me like he was just shoulder biting, but I'll have to look at it again.
I think all these challenges, now you see them back, when you watch them in slow motion, they all look like particularly egregious, but like, You see him in full speed, and sometimes you don't really clock it. It did look bad. It was high. It was needless. Sometimes you see like is the player trying to plant their foot, and then you know obviously, and the other player comes at the same time, and then there's that sort of connection. But to be fair, it completely changed game. But West Ham, man, they look really, really impressive.
This made me reconsider Leicester's win. Was it against Wolves last week?
Yeah.
Where they only won 1-0, and it was from not a fluky, but there's plenty of places that ball could have went when Vardy nipped in at the near post. It could have went over, could have went wide. Like, it wasn't the most intentional of goals. So I was thinking, did Leicester just cling on and nick a result last week? Because they got absolutely hammered, pardon the pun. But Antonio as well looked ridiculous, powerhouse, you know what I mean? Tino was going, he's absolutely shit.
And then 10 minutes later, scored two quality goals.
Yeah, so yeah, West Ham under Moyes, they've just looked unreal. I wouldn't fancy Arsenal against West Ham.
And what a story for like someone like, you know, and Vardy is someone that's been there as well, come from... You know, he was the first conference player to be signed. I think he was I can't remember, was it Fleetwood or something?
It was Fleetwood, yeah.
But were they in the conference at the time or something? I'm sure they paid $1 million for him. And it was like, what are they doing? Are they idiots paying $1 million for like a conference player or a League Two player or whatever?
Yeah.
And then like he's been there for like 12 years, scored, won a Premier League title. And then, but it's the same story with Mikel Antonio. I think I can't remember whether it was West Ham that bought him. It was like Tootham and Mitcham or something like that. Some weird like London-based and like low league side, like sixth division side.
Did you say it was a right back?
And he initially came over as a right back, yeah. And then I think it was Moyes. I think that because they had so many sort of like injury problems or whatever at striker. And he sort of transformed him into this like
put the number
unbelievable
nine
striker. Yeah. I don't know, he's 31 years old. He could get shouts for England, man. Why not?
He's a powerhouse, man.
But he's now West Ham's top Premier League goal scorer.
That's mental.
Isn't it? And he wasn't even a striker when he came there.
A damning indictment of West Ham striking quality over the years. Marlon Harewood, bow your head in shame. Now, but what else happened on the week? Yeah, City won, didn't they?
Man United had a little blip. City back to their imperious ways. 5-0, wasn't it? Was it 5-0? That was this weekend against Norwich.
The football gods willed in Jack Wilshere's first goal. That was it, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, bounced off his leg,
and he celebrated like he just scored a world. I rate him, I do. With United, they were battering Southampton, weren't they?
Yeah, they were all over them for the first like 25 minutes. And then I think, was it around then that the first goal went in?
Yeah, but even then, like, the goal itself for United, I think, was like a nice bit of passing play in tight quarters. I know Pogba fell over, basically, but he still got the assist on the way.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do that in the box when like one give and go, then run, then slide it across. So I felt like this was a solid point for them, because that's easily a game where you can throw everything at the opposing goal and get nothing out of it, and then they nick a goal. At least they got a point out of it. And so it keeps that bit of momentum going. And it was away from home as well. So you can live with that, really, if you're United.
Yeah, and Spurs and Liverpool keep their 100% records. Obviously, you know, Liverpool are going to be a problem. Like this year for many sides, aren't they?
They're looking serious, man.
So I just think you're going to have those teams. They're going to be up near the top. They're not going to drop many points against the sort of like 15, maybe, you know, like sort of 15 to 14, you know, teams down the bottom at the end of the table. You can't see Liverpool, Man City dropping many points against those teams. I think they'll only drop points against the teams amongst them.
Yeah, maybe. We're going to see a few massacres at home, you know, like United. They're going to hammer a few teams at home this season. I'm not too sure about City, man. I don't know. Something's telling me, not that they're not going to absolutely smash it and be there or thereabouts, top two, probably, I'd say, but it's just something about them.
Harry Kane stated his intentions that he's obviously staying at Spurs this season. So he's definitely going to leave at some point, but...
Yeah, but how much of a difference he would have made is a little bit debatable. I've read something this morning that Pep is already eyeing 2023 when his contract expires, and he does that, then he goes to a club, absolutely smashes it for years, wins loads of leagues, spends loads of money, and then he kind of goes out on his own terms. So it'd be interesting. Maybe he's got half an eye on another job already. Not sure. Just not convinced just yet.
I can see. We're going to talk a little bit about the sort of transfer news with the deadline coming in a few days, but I think they will be looking to bring in a striker, certainly.
What about Brighton? Why aren't you surprised about their good start to the season?
Because, obviously, they're 2-2 now? They're one of the 100% records that we've got in the Premier League. But last year, they were creating some of the highest XG and not getting results.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It really doesn't surprise me, man, because they were the team. And there was a little joke on Twitter that they were sort of creating all this XG. Like, we've spoke about expected goals quite a bit and how that is a good, is a fair representation of a team's performance, but not a representation of the points that they accrue.
Yeah.
So it's like they're creating quality chances, but maybe not getting the look or maybe not getting the last finish, or the, you know, the striking hasn't been good enough and the finishing hasn't been good enough. But Neil Maupay, I think he's already off to like two goals from two games. They're scoring goals. They're not conceding many. So I can see him having a good season, man.
Imagine if they're the next Leicester. Imagine if they finally all clicks. No one gets injuries. And the momentum, and then he's like rewarding them with Papa John's every week, like Ranieri used to do.
And then their owners buy him all a Mercedes, whatever. Well, he bought them all a car each, didn't he?
Lovely.
At the end of the season.
It's the least he can do, man.
But rest in peace.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. I can see Brighton getting a top 10 finish, man. So I think that'd be a good bet.
Alongside Brighton, who else do you think? Because for me, Brighton are like a 15 and below top team, probably just staying in the Premier League.
Yeah.
What about Norwich? Any teams like that? Do you see them kind of staying up?
Nah. I just can't see it again. Like they are the biggest yo-yo team we have at the minute, aren't they, Norwich? They just don't know how to... They know exactly how to get promoted. Same with Fulham and West Brom. They're the teams that know exactly how to get out of the Championship. They know how to manage their and pool their resources, how to approach their recruitment, which players to keep, blah, blah, blah. They seem to have found this niche between being able to get promoted but not being able to compete. But they're happy being there, I feel like, them teams are, aren't they?
Well, it's a lovely windfall, isn't it?
Of course it
once
is.
Once you go up. So it doesn't really matter. You're not... You'd be a very... you'd be an exceptional team indeed if you came up from the Championship and was in with a real shout of winning the Premier League. That just does not happen. You know what I mean? So, you'd be happy for the extra... How much is it? 50, 60 mil? Something like that?
Yeah, because I think Fulham got lucky, really, because I think the first season they went up, probably going back about 5 or 6 years, when they went up from the Championship, I think they've been in the Championship for a little bit. They've always been up and down. But... I think they spent a lot of money that first season. It's like something in excess of like 100 million on player transfers, and it didn't go right at all. I think they finished bottom, and I think but I think they got lucky because they spent all this money, and they're probably paying a lot in player wages. And obviously, then these players have probably got sort of 3 or 4 year contracts, so you've still got to sort of abide by their contract, or pay them out of compensation. So obviously, you're stuck, and that's where Blues got stuck a little bit, and that's why we've been in the Championship for bloody like 10 years. So, and a lot of teams, they even fall lower and lower, like Portsmouth, Bradford, teams that have, like Charlton, they've really struggled since getting dropped from the Premier League. But they got a little bit lucky. I think they sort of stabilised themselves, and then they got re-promoted again. And now, I think the second time round, they've thought, right, we're not going to do that. You know what I mean? We're not going to spend all this money on players. We're just going to sort of manage our resources. If we play well, if we do well, we stay up, great. But we're not going to overspend on players.
Yeah, that's healthy, isn't it? Because if the likelihood is you're going down anyway, what's the point in blowing 100 mil?
Because that's what Villa did. Well, Villa spent more, I think, that season they got promoted. They spent more than every club in Europe. The summer transfer window, they spent more than, I think, every club in Europe, bar, say, like Juventus or Barcelona. I can't remember who it was. But, you know, they spent a load of money, but they stayed up and now they're building from it. So it's a real roll of the dice, man. Do you spend, like, 120 million on player transfers, like, put all your eggs in one basket and stay up and hope you stay up? Or do you just manage your resources quite amicably, is that if that's the right word, and try and sort of, like, you know, just make sure that you stay within your own resources, and then hopefully, if you stay up, then lovely. If you get promoted, if you get relegated, then at least you're not, you know, stretching yourself thin.
But there's the commercial aspect as well of having a known name on your team shirt. I wish I didn't speak then, because I had another segue opportunity there. Speaking of Aston Villa, moving on to Tammy Abraham. Thwarted at the last.
Mate, you're loving it today, aren't you?
I know, yeah, the segue king.
On fire.
But Tammy, I reckon. Tammy Abraham, do you reckon he's looked at what Lukaku did and thought, I'll have a bit of that?
I think he obviously got a standing ovation like after his impressive debut against Fiorentina the other day. I think he created 2 assists. Seems to have been doing himself to the fans, to the yellow and red faithful, after a £35 million Chelsea move, which is a great business for them again. Because, you know, he didn't really play that much from, and he was on loan at Aston Villa, wasn't he? Had a great season in the Championship. Come back to Chelsea.
He played all right for Chelsea, though.
Yeah,
he played
quite a bit under Lampard, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think Lampard quite liked him. Clearly, Tommy Tuchel doesn't rate him.
Well, it's a chance to work with Mourinho, first and foremost, which I'm sure countless players would love the opportunity to do. And it's a chance to switch things up in terms of your surroundings. Maybe I can imagine that the social scene and the footballing world in general is quite a small world, like quite insular. So for some players with certain personality types, and depending on your personal circumstances, a change of scenery can be like the best thing in the world. Maybe he's always wanted to get to Italy. The game's a little bit slower there, generally speaking, but more defensive-minded as well. So as a striker, it's not a bad destination to go to try and improve your skills, because he could, imagine he goes there, packs on 10 kilos of muscle and just, you know, comes back ready to dominate for Man City in about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, because he's quite skinny, isn't he? He's tall, but quite skinny. If he can, you know, really beef up and ensure that he's got that physicality factor as well, because he's really good in the air. He's a good finisher. He's quick. Yeah. So he's got all the attributes.
He's got all the tools. And yeah. I think the Italians, I think you've got to give them historically a lot of credit for the way they've been able to maintain the longevity of so many great players. Like, look how many defenders get to the mid, late 30s, even their 40s in Italy. And they're injury-free, playing fairly regularly, and not even just in their league. Remember that AC Milan team from back in the day? It was like Seedorf, like Cafu and all the boys, all in their mid-30s, just like absolutely ripping it. Like, I think it's a good place to go and develop yourself physically, as well as the more tactical side of football.
Nah, I completely agree. And I think it's going to be good for his England chances as well, because you see up a lot of players that do that. You know, if perhaps they're not in favour, they might go somewhere outside Europe. And it's, you know, it's happened a lot with the young players as well. You've got that Musiala that was at Chelsea. He scored a hat-trick the other night for Bayern Munich, albeit in the cup against a lower league German side.
Is that 12-0?
Yeah, when they won 12-0. I think it was that last night. And then obviously you've got Jadon Sancho, who left Man City at the age of 17 to go to Borussia Dortmund. Tammy Abraham's a little bit more established, a little bit older, but even players that feel like they haven't got a chance to like build through the academies in this country, they'll go to somewhere like Germany, somewhere like Italy, where they know they're almost like guaranteed like game time. That's why Jude Bellingham's gone to Dortmund.
Yeah.
Because if he went to someone like Man City or Man United,
he'd be
at
sitting
17
on the bench
old,
for time, wouldn't you?
Yeah, he'd be spending a lot of time on the bench. And there's a lot of Man United players that are doing that as well. Man United, Solskjaer's probably been one of the better coaches in terms of like bringing through the academy players and giving them game time.
Like Greenwood, McTominay, all that. Yeah.
And I think Guardiola's done that with like Phil Foden, so credit to him. And he's doing it with, like, say, Ferran Torres, the Spanish player, who's doing really well and had really good Euros. But I just feel like there's more opportunity for these younger players to go over to Germany and Italy, Spain, and rack up more minutes for top-level teams.
Yeah, for sure, because then they can come back with not only the raw potential and the skills they've developed already, but you get seasoned when you play that many games, cups, and I get it, man. But I think Tammy was not lucky, but those goals last year, I think they would have been called off by VAR, because he gave the two assists and they were razor thin, and I think he benefited from the change.
Is this the Arsene Wenger rule, the one that's been changed slightly to favour the
yeah,
attackers?
Yeah, I think so, that you told me about last week. So
what
I think,
is it? I don't know exactly what it is.
I think basically they're going to give him just a few more millimetres. Like last year, how many times did you see an offside given where it wasn't offside?
Is it which side?
I think which side
they judge the line on, so it's not on the sort of like, I suppose where that thickness of the line, I think they were doing it on the left side rather than the right side. If I'm thinking,
it's a marginal change alteration, but I think it's going to be one that's going to be beneficial, because you do want to give the advantage to the striker, don't you? Really?
Of course. Look, at the end of the day, sponsors, fans, everybody associated with the game, we want to see goals. Yeah. We don't want to see nil-nils. No sadomasochist wants to see nil-nils every week, do they?
Dead.
All right, so we'll move on to the Championship. Obviously, you know, we touched on it slightly with sort of Fulham, West Brom and all the sort of like yo-yo teams of the past. But we'll start with Blues, man. Because obviously, like, you know, a lot of our listeners are Birmingham fans. So what a great 5-0 win against Luton.
The greatest win in the club's history, probably.
Yeah, apart from that Millwall 6-1.
Luton are going to do well this season as well. We keep hearing from everyone.
Yeah, keep on hearing that. Like, Luton are going to have a really good season. But you can't get smacked up by Blues 5-0 and have a good season, I don't think.
I can't remember, like, other than the result you just mentioned, a high-scoring result in Blues' favour. They're not that kind of team, are they? They don't usually string them together like that, so it was quite shocking. I think you were a bit trepidatious before the game. Tino was, as ever, putting white and blue dots in the group chat. Blues, Blues, Blues. But yeah, he wouldn't have betted on that. Did he have a bet on that?
Nah, no way. I don't think anyone in their wildest dreams would have thought we could score 5 goals away from home against a team that was supposedly going to have a good season. But, you know, even at 2-0, I was thinking, right, it's a bit of, you know, it's a bit on the edge, really. We don't know which way it's going to go because it's happened so many times being a Blues fan, like 2-0 up away from home and you've ended up losing like 3-2 or drawing 2-2. So I was thinking like we're probably going to let it slip. But as the goals kept going in, you become even more shocked.
But you were probably reeling from all those losses on Crash Team Racing as well, weren't you, at the time?
Yeah, my mind was on other things.
Yeah, yeah.
But great goals as well. And Tahith Chong, a guy we mentioned last week on loan from Man United, Dutch lad, I think he's only about 19, but he got clapped off the pitch by the Luton fans when he came off. So that's really, really impressive to see that he's absolutely running the show at Blues. And obviously good goals as well. Like, you know, Gary Gardner, you know, he was in with a great finish. So overall, good performances.
It's early days. The Championship is famously turbulent. Where do you see them? Even at this early stage, where do you predict they're going to finish?
I still think they'll be just outside the top six. I think that was kind of my thinking at the start of the season, because Bowyer does seem to have them really organised. Even in that 2-0 loss against Bournemouth, which was last week, they did look organised for the majority of the match, even for, you know, the first 80 minutes. I think it was up until the first goal, 77th minute, I think, Bournemouth scored their first goal. We generally looked really, really organised. So, and we were creating chances. So it's a good combination to have. And I think Bowyer is sort of like setting the foundations there. You know, I he surprised me really coming from Charlton, because I didn't think he would really have the tactical nous to be able to mix it with the Championship. After all the poor managers we've had over how many years.
It's been a shit show, hasn't it? It's
been a nightmare, because when Ator Karanka came in, we all thought, right, that's a great appointment. Like, he's done really well at Middlesbrough, got them promoted. Obviously, in the Premier League, he didn't do so well. But if he can get Blues promoted to the Premier League, like, it'd be amazing. And he was a shambles. Like, he was one of the worst managers we've ever had.
Since Zola.
And that's hard, yeah. That's hard to... It's hard to get up there, because there's been so many poor managers over the years. Like, you know, even the last sort of 5 years, like Gianfranco Zola, Steve Cottrell was a shocker. You know, obviously we've had Monk and Rowett in between there, who were both good, but then, you know, they fucked us off. But yeah, no surprise to see Fulham and West Brom in the top two of the Championship after 4 games.
Classic.
It is a surprise to see Sheffield United in that bottom three, though, like, because they just got relegated from the Premier League, and they were one of those teams that you thought, you know, we were speaking about earlier, that they sort of like stayed within their own means in the Premier League. They didn't really signed too many high-profile players. I think they bought a Norwegian midfielder in for about 14 million quid. I think that was it, really.
3 losses and a draw from 4.
Yeah, so they've started off really, really poorly, and I'm not sure what's going on there. Obviously, Wilder did a great job there, Chris Wilder. He brought him up from League One, I believe. He was like a Sheffield boy, born and bred. He's brought him all the way to the Premier League. Had that amazing first season in the Premier League, where I think they finished 8th, was it, or something. And you know, after he's been sacked, it's just kind of all gone a little bit pear-shaped since then.
Negative momentum is a strong thing.
Yeah, I mean, in sports generally, isn't it?
Yeah, and even if you might get down to the Championship, and even though you've just been relegated, and you should have fire in your belly and thinking, right, we need to stop the rot now. I imagine a lot of those players, depending on their level of professionalism, they might have relaxed even more and just thought, oh, we can beat these boys on talent alone. We're a Premier League team, when in reality, everyone else is scrapping for their lives down in the Championship.
That's what it is, though. The Championship is like that. There's so many teams, and we spoke about this before, there's so many teams that have players that should be in the Premier League and I'm probably getting paid Premier League wages. So it's so difficult. Every week is a tough game in the Championship. Yeah,
absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? And even Forest being there down at the bottom, like, you know, historically a very famous team.
I know, they get forgotten in the shuffle, don't they, Nottingham Forest, a little bit? Because back in the days, Clough and the boys, European Cups, actually,
yeah,
like...
back-to-backs, like...
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Genuinely the best team in Europe. And now it's just, you know, so underwhelming.
And I think they've had the longest stay in the Championship. I think it's like 14 years or something like that they've been in the Championship now.
So, and the level... They might drop another one soon, by the looks of things, man.
But Blues ain't far off it, really. I think we've had, you know, what would he get relegated in 2011, didn't we? So we've been there for 10 years. So too long, so hopefully we can do something this season. Yeah, so that's pretty much it for the sort of footy review from the weekend. We'll have a quick chat about the transfer footy chat and we'll move on to the combat sports stuff. So transfer deadline is just days away. So are we going to see any big profile signings before it slams shut next Tuesday?
Well, they're saying Ronaldo asked to not start the weekend's game against Udinese. He didn't want to play. 95th minute winner denied by VAR. He just can't help himself, can he? The man wants to win in all circumstances. Even if he wants away from the club, he still wants to get his result. He wants his name on the score sheet. So, potential destinations. Apparently, his contract can be bought out for around 25 million. I looked at the odds the other day. This might have changed by now, but Sporting Lisbon was 17 to 1. Man United were 11 to 1. PSG 10 to 1. A return to Real Madrid rated at 6 to 1. And Man City 4 to 1. So
Man City, man. Like, that would start a civil war.
You said they need a striker.
I think it'd be brilliant. I want to see him back in the Premier League, though. Like, you know what I mean? I want to see him back, man.
I think it would be more of an egregious offence if he went directly from United to City, like Tevez did back in the day. But because he's had two clubs in intervening years, and you could, I think in retrospect, when we look back over Ronaldo's career, a lot of people are going to associate him with Real Madrid more than Man United. So I think if he goes to City, I think that's a cool move. I think everyone's just going to be buzzing to see him.
I wonder how much of this has been engineered by his agent, though.
Yeah. This is some real little finger shit, this is, man. They spread stories all the time.
Worm tongues.
Worm tongues. They push buttons. They're like, see who's biting. They leave loads of lines about, it's all a big game, innit? And we're playing it, so fuck
yeah.
It.
But, so what about Mbappe? Because there's rumours that he might be going to Real Madrid.
Maybe he's got a little bit of a fragile ego, Mbappe. I'm starting to think about it. So Real Madrid have offered PSG 137 million for him, which would make sense for Ronaldo's potential switch to Paris if he's to go there. Mbappe would join Benzema, Bale, Asensio, Hazard, Vinicius Jr. and Co on the front line if he were to make the move. Madrid are still on big man things as Barcelona starve. But either way, Mbappe will be playing in the best team in a top-heavy league next year.
Yeah, obviously, Bale's back in the mix now, isn't he, at Real Madrid? I think he scored on the weekend.
Lovely.
Goal and assist.
I'm glad, because he'd been wasted. We've said loads of times that, you know, why wouldn't you just sit on the bench and collect 600 grand? But he's a good player to watch, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, great player to watch. And you know, it's good having him in the team at the end of the day. Like, he's better in playing than sitting on the bench wasting his talent. Obviously, yeah, as you just said, he's getting paid. So for him, it didn't matter whether he's playing or not, particularly because he's going to see out that contract anyway, and there's no way they're going to buy it out. And I don't think anyone else is going to want to really sign him at the age he is. But you never know. And obviously, he had that loan spell at Tottenham, but you know, it probably cost him a fair, penny, didn't it? Vinicius Jr., very, very good player. Hazard got a lot of things to prove for Real Madrid.
He felt like he arrived, didn't he, when he went to Madrid? I think that happens to a lot of players. Think, oh, I'm here now, sweet, and then they get into this. The dressing room itself is full of superstars, yeah. And I feel like you can get lost in that mix. Someone who hasn't got lost in that mix over the years, Karim Benzema. What's the word now? Not commensurate. He's like the perfect professional, basically. So
consummate
professional. That's right. So yeah, there are positive influences in there as well. And I think a player like Mbappe, they're probably going to roll out the red carpet for him. That's a big name to have on the shirt and, you know, all the adulation and all that stuff. So I can really see that happening.
But why wouldn't you want to play with, like, Messi and all those players at PSG? You know, obviously Messi coming, Neymar. Like, why wouldn't you want to be in that trio and just, like, have that chance to become, like, immortal? Imagine if they, like, didn't lose a game, like, all season.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I definitely don't think it's going to happen.
Real Madrid's the bigger club, and they're probably offering him more money, and there's more prestige to go there.
I don't know if they're offering him more money, though.
I reckon they'll be offering him more money.
Well, they probably would have to, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah,
he's,
exactly.
Like, 22 you're not, years old. Yeah, you're not going to take a pay cut in the prime of your career.
You're
like,
buying potential, man, at the end of the day. And as you mentioned earlier, moving on to this next story, Harry Kane, probably going to stay at Spurs now, came on against Wolves for his first season appearance, said he was buzzing with how the supporters responded to him and that he's 100% committed to his team this season, so on and so forth, the usual bullshit. But I was wondering, is this a masterstroke by Daniel Levy or did Man City dodge a bullet?
I wouldn't say it's a masterstroke for Levy. He's a businessman, and 160 million for Harry Kane with 2 years left on his contract, in my opinion, represents great, great money, yeah. A great business.
Yeah.
So what if there was an opportunity to sell him for 160 million with only 2 years left on his contract, I would have sold him.
Yeah, true. But maybe you're just hoping that you can squeeze one last season out of him still. And if he scores 30 goals this season, that price wouldn't have gone down by much.
Yeah, potentially. And then obviously he's going to hope that he can engineer a new contract, which would probably see him stay there for another 5 years. So that'd take him up to like 35, 36 probably. And at that point, he maybe retires or goes to play in sort of MLS or whatever. Is that what he wants to do? Personally, I can't see it. I think he probably, if they don't win anything this season, or if they're not performing, or if they're not in a position where they're looking like they're going to win anything in January, I can't see it. I can't see an avenue. Mind you, he has come out and said that he's staying there for the season, but there's still that period in January where he
could anything can happen, isn't it? Anything could happen.
If they're sixth or seventh in January, and Man City are top of the league and doing well in the Champions League, Tottenham are in the bloody, not even Europa League, they're in like the Europa Conference thing, aren't they, this season?
I think so. By Christmas we'll know.
He's not going to want to play in that particularly, is he?
No. We'll know by Christmas, man. What if Spurs could be top of the league then, lost it?
And potentially they won't have the double whammy of like the sort of Champions League turmoil and then the Premier League and then the FA Cup. They won't have all that because obviously they probably field a lot of weaker players in the sort of Europa Conference League. So you can't see how often Harry Kane's going to play in that. So, it might be good for him as well. Yeah. You know what I mean? So maybe he's not going to play his sort of regular 60-game season. He might play a little bit less or be a little bit fresher.
Yeah, true.
It could work in his favour, especially if he wants to go, if he wants to go and win trophies at the end of the season. Because I can't see Spurs. Can you see Spurs winning a trophy this season?
No, not really.
So I don't think it's going to work out well for him anyway. All right, so are you ready for this week's quiz questions?
As ready as I'll ever be. I know you've got a vengeful mood on you from last week because you got scored a little bit, but
yeah, I can't remember the point differential. I think you're definitely on 3 points.
I got 4 out of a potential 5.5, and I think you got I slightly edged you on the points. But if we're just going by results, it's one win.
One and oh,
yeah.
All right, so I think I've got a feeling you might get a few on this one this week. But last week I thought you weren't going to get any, so it could become complete flip. Right, so question number one. Arsenal have never been relegated from the Premier League since the 1992-92 beginnings, but they have been relegated from England's top division. In what season did this happen? And for a bonus point, can you name who the manager was at the time, 30 seconds from now?
I do not know the answer to this. I don't even know. I don't think I know an Arsenal manager before George Graham. So I'm going to say...
I only know one, Herbert Chapman.
So I'm going to say 1972 they got relegated.
So the answer was 1912 and 1913 season. That was the last time they got relegated from the top tier of English football.
Well, and this year will be the next, won't it?
Yeah. So it's nearly 100 years.
Yeah, it is.
But I don't know, more than 100 years, isn't it? Yeah.
109
2021,
years.
Yeah. And George Morrill was the coach at the time.
Oh, good old Georgie Morrill.
So, if anybody got that who is listening, then give yourselves a pat on the back.
Have yourself an early wank. So.
All right, so number two is going to be a boxing question.
Okay.
And it's going to be your legendary favourite fighter, Manny Pacquiao. So Manny Pacquiao could well have had his last entrance into the boxing ring as a professional after his defeat last weekend. But I want to know who delivered him his first professional loss on February the 9th, 1996. Go.
You've done me, because I know it's like some mad Thai name and I'm never going to be able to remember it. It's like... It's going to be something like Sinsra Kat Saw Rung something or other, isn't it? It is. Oh, I'm tapping out on that one.
I don't think it's that bad.
I'm never going to be able to do it. Go on. I'll tap out in 20 seconds. I just want to know the answer now. Go on.
It is Rusio Torocampo.
Come on, man.
Which isn't that. It's not that Thai sounding.
Yeah. I didn't really have that in the
locker. The Filipinos have got all sorts of mad names, haven't they?
There's one Thai fighter called 3K Battery.
So that's cheer us up.
Yeah, cheers. You're energised. But I'm 0-2, man. In my wheelhouse, Arsenal and Manny Pacquiao. And it's great. I hope I get these generic ones. Oh, don't drop your phone out of excitement that you're going to win the quiz.
All right, so your number three.
Your
number third question is going to be back to football, kind of. So I want to know which hymn has been sang at the FA Cup final since 1927.
songs, though. Hymns.
Yeah. This fucked me up the other day because it was on the Daily Mail.
Is it Hosanna, Hosanna?
No, I'm glad that you pulled some sort of hymn out your arse.
I know a lot of hymn lyrics off the top of my head.
It kind of sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like it should be like a Sugar Babes tune.
Go on then.
Abide with me.
Abide.
Do you know that hymn?
How does that go?
I don't know. Should we get it on?
We should clip it into the episode.
We will.
Mr. Roman Catholic Church wants to do us for copyright. Well, I think they've got bigger fish to fry.
All right, so you're 0 for 3, and I'm going to another favourite sport of yours. In which year did Roger Federer win his first Wimbledon title?
2002.
I'll give you another guess.
2001.
Ah, 2003.
For fuck's sake, I did that last week. Yeah. Yeah. There's a clue in the title. You're like, 9. Yeah.
No, it literally says 8. I literally said 8.
I was close enough with that. With the other three, I had literally no clue, but I knew it was kind of... Yeah, go on.
All right, and the last one.
Go on, then.
Now, obviously, I can't tell you what sports it's from, because that's the clue in the question. So, the Fosbury flop, which has nothing to do with erectile dysfunction, is a technique used in which sport?
The Fosbury flop?
Think about body. Like, what would you have to do with your body to flop your body, like, in sports?
Or is it diving? Or swimming?
Think
or
Olympics. Like, yeah, you think Olympics.
Is it the
track and field?
Olympics, the Fosbury flop.
If you were flopping,
or is it like a high jump?
Yeah, high jump.
He's led me to it. What a good man. 23 seconds, 0.94 on the clock. He gets 1 out of 5.
At least he hasn't got a duck.
We're gonna have to see how you do next week to determine, or the next episode, to see how we match up against each other. But I am quite, after such a strong start 2 weeks ago, quite disappointed with that. But
I'm quite hopeful. I'm quite hopeful that next week I might be able to get 2.
I've got no complaints about the quality of the questions either. I think all of them, except the hymn one, which is a bit left field, I think they're all fair. I think they're all fair questions.
Yeah, I mean, the bonus question one in the Arsenal one was a bit horrible. Like, you'd have to be an Arsenal enthusiast.
Arsenal anorak.
Yeah, like an encyclopedia of Arsenal knowledge to know that one. So that bonus question was a bit horrible. And I didn't throw in any other bonus questions there, really, did I?
It's all right. I don't think I would have been any more successful. But next week, I'm going to try and do some sneaky ones to you, man, which seem reasonable, but they're really not.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one to do it.
So there you go. 1 out of 5. I've got to beat that next week to get back on the board, man.
Yeah, you will. Well,
got those 3 points.
Looking forward to it.
Let's do the combat sports stuff then, because we've got a couple of big fights to talk about from the weekend. One in the boxing, one in the UFC, and then we've got a little preview of that circus that's coming on this weekend.
Yeah, well, this boxing review is only going to cover one topic, but it's an obituary, so it's a bit lengthy, isn't it? So the end has come for Manny Pacquiao as an elite level fighter. Last Saturday, he dropped the unanimous decision to the Cuban Yordanis Ugas by 2 scores of 116-112 and a third by 115-113, all of which I thought were rather kind to Manny Pacquiao, I've got to say. Ugas was a minimalist in there. He had a high guard. He was moving by inches, playing with that mid-range to avoid Pacquiao's combinations. Over the years, opponents have either glued their gloves to their temples or tried to lean off to the side, and to their detriment. Ugas' tactics were a subtle, confident solution to that problem, and there were no tells on his punches either. His jab was a pleasure to watch. The right hook to the head was a constant threat, and he battered Pacquiao's body as well. I think he tried to get Pacquiao out of there in the 12th, but couldn't manage it. Other than that, a tremendous performance overall from him. I think Pacquiao would have struggled against Ugas 5 years ago, to be honest. The size, the reactiveness, the patience, it was a bad style matchup for him in the end. And there was a stiffness to Pacquiao that I'd never quite seen before. He was gritting and wrenching when he was throwing his punches. Everything was an effort for him. And he was taking some brutal shots in there as well, especially as the fight wore on. He was cutting the 12th and already bruised up badly by then. I think it's really a case of, look, you can't stop the clock. Pacquiao, he was going to deteriorate at some point, and I'm glad it happened against a proper fighter. It would have been so depressing if he was got banged out by some nobody. At 42 years old, 26 years as a pro behind him, countless mega events and million-dollar paydays, Pacquiao may never step foot in the ring again. I'm alright with that, to be honest. I want to enjoy the fighter he was rather than what he is today. And he'll probably be president of the Philippines soon anyway, so it's all good.
Looking back at the highlights of the fight, the first thing I noticed was there was a significant size difference, not just as in, like, you know, how much taller the Cuban was in comparison to Manny Pacquiao. But just the sheer size, bulkiness difference.
Massive, isn't it?
He just looked huge compared to him. And obviously, I can feel how gutted you are, because obviously, you know, we've spoke a lot about him being your favourite fighter and that. And I think you sort of like reflect the sort of feelings of boxing fans worldwide. But I don't think this defeat taints his legacy as one of the greatest fighters of all time. And as you intonated to there, Ugas is clearly a fighter in his peak years. He's had more title fights in the last 2 years than he has in his previous 10. He only making his debut in 2010 at the age of 24. And the question for you is, and coming through the Olympic circuit that we all know the Cubans are like so good at and famously successful, I think he got a bronze in 2008. Yeah. Do you think that this has kept him sort of fresh and hungry, even at the age of 35?
If you're made to delay your professional debut because of the political situation in your country, and in doing so extend those 3-round fights in the amateurs, you're not going to be taking as much punishment. I mean, we saw the difference between pro boxing and the amateurs when the Olympics have just gone by. So he's not having wars against all-time greats like Pacquiao has been having for the past 15-20 years. So it was a case of freshness as much as disparity in age. I completely agree with you there. Yeah. Ugas is a good fighter, man. He pushed Sean Porter all the way, I think it was a year or two ago.
Yeah.
He's technically proficient. He's confident and he doesn't get scared in that moment. He wasn't overawed by the occasion. And it was a well-earned victory for him. He can't really say anything about it. If he wasn't, it's because it's Pacquiao and because of who he is and what he means to the sport, to me and to so many other people, that it seems like a massive deal. But it kind of makes sense when you weigh everything up.
And there was quite a poignant moment in the 12th round where I was watching through the highlights. It cut to Pacquiao's wife. And she just sort of had her head in her hands. I don't think she could really believe what was happening, or she knew it was coming and she just couldn't face watching it. So does this defeat kind of perhaps give us a sense of relief that he didn't come up against undefeated Errol Spence, who's 11 years his junior, has beaten names like Sean Porter, as used the internet to Kell Brook, Danny Garcia. I think Sean Porter beat Ugas, didn't he?
Yeah,
so it's like, that shows you the sort of level difference that he would have been coming up against. Up against Errol Spence. And I know boxing ability, it's not measured by age, but when you're talking about fighters that are quality opponents, that's 7-11 years younger than you,
it's
and
a factor,
42
man.
Years old.
Yeah, it's a factor for sure. And I expressed relief last week when Errol Spence pulled out of this fight because of his retinal tear. I remember being dodged a bullet there. I really think it would have been a knockout for Errol Spence Jr. This weekend, we're going to see the latest in a long line of bastardised boxing matches between Jake Paul and Tyron Woodley. Earlier this week, I watched the BT Sports preview of this featuring John Fury, Dan Hardy and some other guy who I didn't know. And all of them were picking Jake Paul to win the fight. And I was baffled. Look, I know Jake Paul is the bigger guy, but that's about the only advantage he has. They suggested that Woodley potentially could gas out as the fight wears on. Jake Paul's never been past 2 rounds in his life. And in this fight, Woodley doesn't have to worry about getting a shin in the face or getting mauled on the ground. So I didn't understand their logic. But they also spoke about Jake Paul's acumen in the mind games department. He's offered a handful of side bets to Woodley, who's turned them all down. And the panel took that as Woodley lacking confidence in some way. That could potentially be the case. Or it could be that Woodley is refusing to engage at all, which I would consider an advantage to him. But you wouldn't get involved in the mind games with someone like Jake Paul, who's one of the biggest trolls in the world. It's just, you're never going to win that fight, are you? It's like trying to verbally spar with a prime Conor McGregor. You're just going to look like a div at the end of the day. So Woodley's making his professional debut here, but those MMA boys spar with big gloves all the time. So I can't imagine the environment or the equipment somehow unsettling him. However, he is 39 years old, which could play a part in terms of his activity level as the fight wears on. But I don't see this fight going past 4 rounds anyway. Jake Paul has beaten a YouTuber, a basketball player, and an overweight wrestler with a bad hip in his previous 3 fights. And they're his only 3 fights. I know Woodley is skidding on 4 losses in the UFC, but this is a different sport and one that will allow Woodley to utilise his greatest asset, which is his punching power.
Is Woodley... He's not officially retired from the UFC either.
No. So... I think his last fight out was it against Colby Covington? No, against Vicente Luque, and then Covington, Usman, and then before that. So
he's fought some he's fought some high caliber.
He was at the top of the UFC in a brutal era. His wins against Robbie Lawler, Darren Till was no one wanted to fight him. He dropped him with a counter right hand and choked him out of a DOS. So listen, you can't mess with him. Even in his draw with Stephen Thompson, that was a brutal fight. The rematch was a bit like, you know, boring or whatever. But if there's even a shadow of the former UFC welterweight champion still alive and kicking somewhere in Woodley, he's going to batter Jake Paul. I don't say that smugly either. You know, I think Jake Paul brings a lot of attention to boxing and MMA with this weird little campaign he's on. And there are residual benefits to fighters because of that. I like that aspect of what he's doing. But I also think that even a smaller, older, shop-worn Tyron Woodley can hit very hard for a short amount of time. And I believe decades of experience at that top level are going to really stand him in good stead. He's not that far away from his prime to be getting blasted out by a 23-year-old-ish kid who's really only started boxing in the last couple of years. I just don't see it, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, right? I mean, it seems like there's a huge... It's a huge step up from his previous fights. Obviously, guys that have never been in the ring. And then you've got the wrestler.
Ben Askren. Askren was unusual in MMA for how little he decided to exchange strikes with people. It just wasn't part of his repertoire. He wanted to latch onto you, drag you to the ground and hit you while you're there or try and submit you. He's not standing, slipping punches and coming back with left hooks to the body and all that. It just weren't happening. Woodley has...
He was really out of shape,
yeah, obviously. Really out of shape, yeah. So, like, and again, Jake Paul stacking it. He's the much bigger guy in all these fights. And that is the case against Woodley as well. But I think Woodley is... He knows how to slip shots and counter. He knows how to pace around. In MMA, it's 5-minute rounds. In boxing, it's 3-minute rounds. Add to that the fact that he doesn't have to wrestle. He doesn't have to kickbox. He doesn't have to defend submissions. There's so many energy outlets are going to be left to him to just focus on boxing. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's something going around in the inner circle that I'm not aware of, but I just don't see him beating Tyron Woodley.
See, the endorphins are going mad in my head because you're making me believe that there might be a lot of value in backing Woodley. Because if the experts are all thinking this, the bookmakers might go with and make... I haven't looked at the odds yet,
yeah.
But making Jake Paul the favourite, which would be crazy, really, wouldn't it?
If you put everything on the line, I don't see how that adds up to Jake Paul being the favourite. I really don't. You having a quick look now?
I am going to have a quick look, yeah. Because I'm intrigued. I'm extremely intrigued. Might have a one-er on Woodley.
You've got one-ers to burn, you have, man.
No, I had a little bet the other day. A little bit.
Just a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. Oh, they've done us dirty. Basically, Jake Paul's 4-9, which means he's like his favourite. So you'd assume that Woodley would be almost a reflection of that. So he'd be like 2-1, but he's 13-8, which is like 1.5. Still, though...
Covering the odds.
Still, that might be worth 50 quid on Woodley. Mind you, everything's set up for him to win, ain't it?
And that's what John Fury was saying, which from that side, I get where he's coming from. That's what's making me think, is there something I don't know here? Because if you put it... Let's just assume they're both... Neither of them are injured. Let's just assume... Let's take that as a given. Jake Paul's much bigger than Tyron Woodley. Like, he stands probably a foot taller than him when they both got their trainers on and that. But I just don't see it, man. I do not see it at all. I can see Woodley launching masses of right hands at him. If Jake Paul can get out of the way for a little bit or do something that I haven't seen him do so far in his boxing. And bear in mind, Floyd Mayweather's like been giving Woodley a few tips and that. Do you know what I mean? So,
I mean, I hope he knocks him out. But like all the shit that, like, you know, Jake Paul's already been coming out with. Like today I saw that he was like, you know, calling Masvidal a bitch and calling him out and saying he'd like... getting a boxing ring with him, you know, almost going on like already after the fights that he's won that he's going to be like this huge name in boxing.
This is where his genius lies. He knows.
I wouldn't call it genius, man. Listen, like, it's not a genius.
The kid's 22, 23 years old, whoever he is. He wasn't even part of my world like a year and a half ago. Do you know what I mean? And through his antics and through winning even these suspect fights that he's been winning, he's generating attention. He knows how people respond. He's like, oh, shots fired. He's like banking on the shots fired culture, innit? By calling out genuinely dangerous fighters. And people know now that it's a possibility that he's going to fight them. So this is just generating more interest. If he beats Tyron Woodley, the door opens to an even bigger payday. It's just like, he's playing us all, man. He's playing us all. I'm going to watch, not by, you know, legitimate means, but I'm going to watch. I'm going to follow and be interested in his story and all that kind of stuff. So he's got us all hooked, man. There's something to be said for his business acumen at the very least, man.
I mean, we'll see what happens with it obviously, from a sort of fighting perspective, it sounds like we should be sort of leaning towards Woodley, but we'll see. But let's talk about the MMA review of the weekend then.
So last weekend, this one stoked up quite a bit of controversy, but it was a close result in my opinion. So Jared Cannonier, I've reviewed how people say that, and I think it's Cannonier, not Cannonier, as I was saying.
Yeah, Cannonier, I think they
were
saying
very French. So Cannonier edged Kelvin Gastelum 48-47 on all three judges' scorecards at the UFC's main event last week. I had it two rounds apiece with the fourth going either way, but Cannonier did drop Gastelum in the second, I think, and I preferred his work overall. He was catching Gastelum with hard knees and sneaky elbows on the way in. At 37, Cannonier's balance, his reaction time, his coordination were out of this world, and he's kept himself in the conversation for a title shot with this win. Gastelum, meanwhile, is running out of lives in the UFC. That's now one win in six for him and only three wins in the last nine. And I know some of those losses were close against Adesanya and Darren Till in particular, and losses aren't as damaging to a fighter's reputation as in boxing, but there are limits to how many you can lose and still keep your job. Why not consider a move to Bellator or the PFL while he's still only 29 and can command a premium to fight an overall less fearsome opposition? We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and they're getting paid well in the Bellator, isn't it? And we're going to talk briefly about sort of like what UFC fighters are getting paid and whether, you know, whether Dana White is actually giving his fighters the fair share of what they should be getting. But I mean, this fight to me, like, it looked like it had not much in it in the first couple of rounds. Like, to be honest, there wasn't much to separate, and both fighters had impressive moments. Gassam looked like he'd rocked Cannonier in the second with that quick combination of the right hand jab following up with that left, and he was doing that quite a lot. I think that was his sort of like go to attack. The inside kicks looked like they were a massive advantage for him. They were causing Cannonier a problem throughout. However, I think Cannonier smoked Gastelum with a right hook in the third, which you thought had, he looked like he had Gastelum in all kinds of trouble. John, and we were speaking about this just briefly before we started the podcast. How he just looked like Gastelum, you know, we was on about the ragdoll physics in games.
Yeah, it looked it like just, that.
But then he got grabbed straight away and managed to do the full 4 minutes.
How scary would that be if you crack, and you know you've hit someone, like, that's a sweet shot, bang, hit him right on the button, perfect technique, perfect power, and he just pops right back up and carries on coming at him.
Undertaker resilience, that's what I was comparing it to. Like, I love it when fighters do that. Like Tyson Fury against
But it wasn't even like Wilder. He didn't even allow his back to touch the mat. Mm. Do you know what I mean? He just popped straight back up, which I thought was, you know, this is what I'm saying, Gastelum, he's had a tough run, but he's a really durable, capable fighter, and he's just missing by inches every time, man.
Yeah, it's a shame for him. But the stats shown that there was a 17-point differential of significant strikes in favour of Cannonier in that third round, with the American also taking the first in terms of significant strikes by 24-18. So he did, like, the rounds that Cannonier won, he won quite significantly, Gastelum just about edged.
Yeah. That's a fair assessment of it, which probably lended to my overall impression of the fight. Based on the points, I probably wouldn't have minded if Gastelum won, but in terms of how the fight actually went, I'll go with Cannonier.
And I think Cannonier's takedown defence as well probably edged the judge's decision, because I think Gastelum was 0-8 on his takedown attempts.
I think he managed to get him down briefly twice, but Cannonier popped straight back up, so yeah, couldn't do anything with him. But the post-fight interview was interesting, because I thought, like, what the fuck? How little are these guys being paid? After the fight, Cannonier was like, yeah, I want to fight as soon as I can because I'm broke. And this, you know, is part of the ongoing conversation about fighter pay that Jake Paul, for everything that people dislike about him, has been highlighting about the situation, really. So I was thinking, okay, are they really underpaying fighters that much? And I found this Bloody Elbow article where Cannonier is quoted as saying the following. After this win, 60% of my money is already gone. Between the gym, between management, between taxes. On top of that, I've got bills, credit cards, I've got kids, I've got a house in Alaska, I've got a house down here, I've got car payments. That money goes. The money don't last forever. He says, right now, fighting is our only revenue. I don't have sponsors or anything like that. Fighting's my only focus. I'm not out here doing commercials or anything like that. Nobody's asking me to be in the next Marvel movie. And not being able to fight for the last 10 months put a strain on my pockets. Everybody's saying the UFC needs to pay its fighters. In my situation, when I quit my job, I was able to get paid from the UFC to sustain myself. So I'm not here to say the UFC isn't paying me well, because I'm getting paid pretty good from the UFC. It's just that money don't last forever. He says, I'm not balling out of control. I'm not splurging or anything like that. I'm not stupid. I don't spend money on dumb stuff. But it's just life, I guess. So that highlighted to me. It's kind of a practical approach to the whole thing. Like not a victim's mentality, not a poor me, not I want millions of dollars. He's just saying that he's got practical requirements in life, and because of the way things have been, not fighting regularly, his only source of income has been stopped. So I think it was a refreshing viewpoint to hear from Cannoneer, really, because I imagine a lot of headliners, like Paulo Costa, for instance, after he lost in embarrassing fashion to Adesanya, for his next fight, he was requesting like 500 grand or something, which in terms of the UFC's pay scale is out of the question. For a top headliner in boxing, it's probably not out of the question, but it's about realism and practicality and all that, isn't it? So I'm glad that they highlighted that.
Yeah, he didn't go through the perspective of like, oh, woe is me.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, as you say, he's been quite clinical in his sort of assessment of his own sort of like situation. And the thing is, like, mixed martial artists are in a profession where, you know, even if you wanted to fight every couple of months, you can't, because you physically, your body will not be able to maintain that level of stress. So it's a really difficult position to be in. Even if you're fighting, say, twice a year, you're probably not making as much money as you'd expect, you know, these headliners to make, like the main events. So it must be really, really tough, and tough on the family as well, because at the end of the day, you know, if you're the wife of, say, Cannoneer, we'll use him as an example, because we're talking about him. So if you're the wife of Cannoneer and you're sort of like, you're watching your husband having to go out twice a year, you know, potentially like get his head kicked in, just to make money to put food on the table and to pay the bills and, you know, to pay off these credit cards and pay for the kids' like future college fees and all these things that the regular human being has to go with.
But he's paying a serious price for it, man.
But he's paying the hardest price for it, man. Because he has to get beat up to do it.
But yeah, I mean,
it's rough, man. It is rough.
I don't know enough about the ins and outs of the UFC's pay structure, but I would prefer for them to get more. But the cards keep on rolling, man. They are a juggernaut, aren't they? But there's only the UFC Vegas card this weekend. Edson Barbosa and Giga Chikadze. But I don't really, there's nothing else to report, really. So a pretty quiet one on the Western front.
Yeah, it's just the old Jake Paul and Woodley
and all that stuff. Yeah, so I'll be watching.
I think next week, potentially, if we have got next week, because this will be our last one before I move back to the US. Potentially we'll have some NFL previews. If we do one sort of like on the weekend of next weekend.
Go Bears.
So go Bears. They didn't have a good outing last time.
Now
they lost like 41-16 or something in a preseason friendly.
Boo Bears.
So not very good. Great to see you again, as always.
A pleasure.
Yeah, we'll might have a week off. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
We'll see how it works out. But if not, we'll be back the week after with episode 31.